It was carved from the earth by tectonic fury, divided by empire, and reclaimed by blood. Panama isn't just a country, it's a corridor of power, a prize fought over by kings, colonizers, drug lords, and superpowers. For centuries, outsiders controlled its destiny. But this is the story of how a nation fought to reclaim its voice through betrayal, revolution, dictatorship, and defiance. From gold routes to gunfire, from canal riots to climate battles, this is the untold saga of Panama, the land between two oceans, and the people who refuse to be a bridge for others while going nowhere themselves. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Panama, A Journey Through Time, Episode 1. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Land Before Borders. Before there were lines drawn in ink across paper maps, before kings laid claims to soil they'd never seen, before steel tracks and steaming engines carved through the jungle like scalpels, there was the land, the spine of the world, formed not by men, but by the patient violence of the earth itself. The Isthmus of Panama did not simply appear. It was born in cataclysm, in fire, in the grinding crush of tectonic plates over millions of years. Beneath the oceans, volcanic arcs surged, collided, and fused, rising slowly to the surface until they formed a bridge where none had been. Two continents, once sundered by deep blue, were bound forevermore, not by politics, not by trade, but by geology. This thin strip of earth, barely 50 miles wide at its narrowest point, altered the planet's destiny. Oceans that once mingled freely, Atlantic and Pacific, were divided. Ocean currents shifted. Global climates changed. Animals that had never before met began to walk the same forest paths. And through it all, the land waited, breathing in green silence. The first humans to walk Panama's soil arrived long before anyone named it. Thousands of years ago, perhaps as far back as 12,000 BCE, bands of Paleo-Indians, hunters, and gatherers came south from what is now North America, chasing herds and hope. They did not yet know they were passing into what would become a crossroad of empires. All they knew was the jungle, the rivers, the ocean tides that pulled them closer toward the unknown. These early settlers lived in harmony with the land because they had to. The rainforest was no gentle cradle. It was alive and aware, layered in danger and promise. Every step could yield food or death. The people learned to listen to the rhythm of the birds, to the shifting moods of the rivers, to the warning buzz of insects before storm. Over time, they ceased to be migrants and became rooted. Villages rose along coastlines and rivers, their footprints shallow but persistent. They fished the sea, hunted the tapir and peccary, and carved their stories into stone and bone. They left behind fragments, obsidian arrowheads, intricately painted ceramics, burial mounds layered with gold and shell, and the bones of ancestors who gazed skyward long before gods had names. By 2500 BCE, agriculture had taken root. The people of Panama were cultivating maize, manioc, and cacao. Corn wasn't just food, it was a sacred offering, a contract with the earth. As they domesticated crops, they also domesticated time, marking the seasons and stars. They crafted clay into vessels, into art, into offerings for the dead. Life became layered, ritual, labor, trade, memory. Among the most sophisticated were the cacao, a culture that flourished in the central lowlands near what is now the Rio Grande de Cacao. They are perhaps Panama's most evocative ghost, gone in name, but immortal in gold. Their artisans created some of the most exquisite pre-Columbian gold work in the Americas. Pendants in the shape of bats, jaguars, warriors, mid-roar. These were not mere ornaments, they were talismans, worn by the elite to commune with gods and ancestors. Death for the cacao was not an end, but a passage, and they buried their rulers in elaborate tombs, surrounded by offerings and sometimes even sacrificed attendants. These tombs, long hidden beneath jungle and time, would centuries later become the focus of obsessive treasure hunters, but their true value lay not in the glitter of gold, but in the echoes they preserved. To the west and north lived the Ngei Bugle, a resilient people whose lineage stretches unbroken from the pre-contact era to the present day. In the mountains and cloud forests, they hunted with spears and bows, practiced slash-and-burn agriculture, and held deep spiritual bonds with nature. Each river had a guardian, each tree a whispering spirit. Oral tradition flowed through generations, preserving a cosmology far older than the Bible or Quran. To the Ngabe, time was not linear. It spiraled. What had happened would happen again if the people forgot the sacred laws of balance. To the east, in the Darien Gap, the Kuna Guna carved out their space in the mangrove swamps and along the Caribbean. Masters of canoe travel and river navigation, they were fiercely independent and culturally rich. Their cosmology centered around a creation story involving sacred spirits who shaped the land and sky with song and sacrifice. Women held powerful roles as spiritual leaders and traders. The Kuna would become known centuries later for their embroidered molas, layered textile art that preserved ancestral myth in color and thread. But even now, their ancestors were already stitching culture into memory. Trade routes spanned the isthmus long before conquistadors dreamed of gold. Goods moved hand to hand: salt, obsidian, feathers, shells, cacao, jade, and knowledge. Along these routes, language spread. So did ideas. Panama, even then, was a connector, a place of movement and exchange. It was a breathing corridor, carrying the lifeblood of Mesoamerica and South America in both directions. But make no mistake, this land was never passive. The environment shaped the people as much as they shaped it. Rainforest canopy loomed like a cathedral, its silence broken only by howler monkeys or the rustle of jaguars. The Darien was impassable in parts, a wall of swamp and shadow. The Caribbean coast, though dazzling, was storm-racked and unforgiving. And yet they endured. These were not civilizations that sought to dominate nature, but to negotiate with it. Theirs was a relationship of respect, of constant dialogue. And then came the omens. Strange lights in the sky. Distant stories carried downriver of pale-skinned men with metal skins and thunder weapons. Whispers of a sea that foamed with ships. The Kuna tell stories, still, today, of dreams their ancestors had before the Spanish arrived. In those dreams, the balance was breaking. The land could feel it. The forest knew. It would take only a few generations for everything to change. Diseases the likes of which no shaman could cure. Crosses replacing sacred groves. Gold taken not as offering, but as plunder. Cities burning. Languages falling silent. But that was still to come. In this first chapter of Panama's story, before the guns and flags, before the railroads and canals, there was only land and those who knew how to listen to it. The isthmus was a cradle of culture, a whispering bridge, a sacred scar that joined two worlds and birthed a thousand more. The jungle remembers them. In the ruins near Sidi Oconte, in the shadowed caves of Darien, in the riverbeds that still churn up fragments of carved stone and gold, the past rises like mist in the morning. And so we begin, not with conquest, not with empire, but with silence, with the breath of the earth, with the footsteps of the first humans, etched lightly in mud that has since become memory. Panama was never an afterthought. It was always the axis, the hinge, the hidden heartbeat of the hemisphere. Chapter 2, When the Conquerors Came. It began not with war, but with wonder. A shimmer on the horizon, a sail where none had ever been. And for those who saw it first, from the coastlines of Gunayala, from the mouths of river deltas, from the lookouts woven into the forest canopy, it must have felt like the breath of some ancient prophecy coming to life. A wound being opened in the skin of the world. The year was 1501 when the Spaniards first brushed Panama's shores. Rodrigo de Bastidas sailed along the Caribbean coast, mapping and observing, his expedition cautious but hungry. He didn't linger. He was the scout, the prelude. But behind him came others. More ships, more steel, more ambition. In 1502, Christopher Columbus himself passed along the coast during his fourth voyage. He anchored near what is now Almirante Bay, describing the riches of the jungle and the seeming docility of its people. But even Columbus, already seasoned in conquest, sensed resistance in the trees. The Spanish came with dreams soaked in gold. Not metaphorical gold, literal, molten, gleaming treasure. Their myths spoke of golden empires to the south. They believed that the isthmus was merely a hurdle on their path to El Dorado. They had no idea that Panama was not an obstacle, but a crucible. By 1508, the crown had granted exploration rights over the region. They divided the land they had never seen into two imagined governorships, Castilla del Oro to the east and Veragua to the west. The names themselves were drenched in greed. The gold of Castile, the true shore. For the Spanish, the land was not sacred. It was a ledger, a prize. But this was no empty wilderness waiting to be claimed. The interior was alive with complex societies, many small-scale and autonomous, others part of regional chiefdoms with defined authority, trade networks, and military alliances. The Ngabe controlled the highlands and western jungles. The Cueva occupied the central and eastern interior. The Cuna, adept seafarers, dominated the Caribbean coastlines and river mouths. Each of these groups had their own languages, cosmologies, and systems of governance. They were not passive victims. They were nations. Still, the Spanish were persistent. In 1510, a foothold was established at Santa Maria la Antigua del Darién, near the mouth of the Atrato River. It was the first permanent European settlement on the mainland of the Americas. The land resisted them with insects, disease, and terrain. The jungle, which they had hoped to tame, answered back with rot and fever. Men died by the dozens, bones gnawed by wild pigs and buried in shallow, mosquito-ridden graves. And yet they stayed. Among the conquistadors was a restless, cunning man named Vasco Núñez de Balboa, a failed planter, a stowaway, a man driven by ambition that clung to him like sweat. He arrived hidden in a barrel aboard a ship, desperate to escape debt in Hispaniola. But in the steaming swamps of Darién, he saw opportunity. Balboa was no mere adventurer. He was observant, persuasive, and brutal when required. He befriended, or manipulated, the local Guna leaders, learning their rivalries and internal politics. He adopted native dogs for hunting, native weapons for fighting, and native intelligence for navigating the unknown. It was from these alliances and betrayals that Balboa learned of a great sea to the south, across the mountains. The indigenous people had no word for Pacific, but they spoke of waters that stretched endlessly, where the sun sank and strange ships had never sailed. It was not gold that drove Balboa next, it was discovery, or at least the glory of being the first to see what others only whispered of. In September of 1513, with a ragged band of 190 Spaniards and several hundred native porters and warriors, Balboa set off on an overland march through the dense interior. The expedition slogged through rain-drenched forests, across treacherous rivers, and into territory controlled by rival chiefs who had no intention of letting foreigners pass unchallenged. Battles were fought. Settlements were burned. Captives were taken. Balboa moved not like an explorer, but like a storm. A witness wrote that they hanged a chief and 60 of his men from the trees as a warning. Another entry described indigenous warriors impaled alive along the path, a macabre fence of resistance crushed. But at last, they reached the summit of a mountain range. There, on the morning of September 25th, Balboa strode ahead of his men. Standing atop a ridge, he saw the vast shimmer of the Pacific Ocean unfurl before him. He raised his sword and claimed the sea for Spain. He named it the South Sea, unaware that it would come to define the geography and destiny of the planet. The moment has become legend, carved into marble and myth, the conqueror gazing upon endless waters, triumphant. But from the other side of that gaze, from the point of view of the people whose mountains he crossed and whose chiefs he hanged, what did it look like? Not a moment of triumph, but of trespass. A curse spoken into the wind. A door flung open, never to be closed again. With Balboa's discovery, Panama's role as a corridor of empire was sealed. In the coming years, Panama would become a choke point through which the riches of Peru flowed to Spain. The isthmus was now a bridge for conquest, not just of land, but of entire civilizations. Balboa's reward was short-lived. political intrigues swirled in the new world like a tropical storm. His rivals, jealous and fearful of his rising influence, accused him of treason. In 1519, the new governor, Pedrarias Davila, an old ally turned enemy, had Balboa arrested, tried, and beheaded. His severed head was displayed on a pike in Santa Maria. The man who first laid European eyes on the Pacific died not in glory, but in betrayal. Meanwhile, the Cueva people, who had once dominated central Panama, were decimated within decades. Disease swept through their villages like wildfire. Smallpox, influenza, measles, the biological weapons of empire. Thousands died without ever seeing the face of a Spaniard. Entire languages were silenced. Memories dissolved into bones that no one would remember to bury. The Spanish, in their records, called the land pacified. They measured peace not by harmony, but by silence, by the absence of resistance. By 1519, Panama City was founded on the Pacific coast, the first permanent European settlement there. It would become the launching point for further conquest into South America. Horses, carts, slaves, and silver would all pass through its port. Panama had become a staging ground, a pipeline, a gear in the machinery of empire. But even in this early moment of defeat, resistance flickered. The Guna retreated to islands. The Ngabe withdrew into mountains. The Embra scattered deep into the Darien. They would survive not by confronting the Spanish in open battle, but by adapting, by evading, by waiting. Some allied, others fled, others plotted revenge. Rebellions would smolder across the centuries like embers under ash. This chapter in Panama's story is not just about conquest. It is about the moment before collapse, the eight before the fall. It is about two worlds staring at each other across a gulf of misunderstanding and power, each trying to grasp what the other meant. The Spanish saw a land to be mapped, mined, and Christianized. The indigenous peoples saw invaders who poisoned rivers, renamed gods, and slaughtered the innocent. And yet, from this violent collision, something new began to form. A scar, yes, but also a memory. A new world stitched from blood, belief, and betrayal. The sails would keep coming. The swords would keep flashing. But the land would remember. The jungle would remember. The people, those who survived, would remember. Even now, 5 centuries later, when the rains fall in the Darien and the fog wraps around the hills of Cockle, the earth carries the memory of first contact. Not as triumph, but as wound. Chapter 3, Gold, Blood, and the Camino Real. If the earth had veins, Panama would have been one of them. A narrow, pulsing artery through which the lifeblood of a dying continent was drained. Gold, silver, flesh, and fear all poured across its back like offerings to a greedy god. Spain called it progress. The locals called it something else. A slow death, paved in stone and betrayal. The year was 1519, and Panama City had just been born. Not in peace, not in prosperity, but in the wake of conquest, cloaked in smoke and shadows. Governor Pedrarias Davila, the same man who had orchestrated the beheading of Vasco Núñez de Balboa, now stood over the Pacific with his boots in the surf and his gaze fixed southward. To him, Panama was not an end, it was a beginning. A port of ambition, a gateway to the vast, unspoiled riches of the Andes that Spanish maps were only just beginning to imagine. From that perch, the Spanish launched some of the most consequential expeditions in world history. It was from here, in 1524, that Francisco Pizarro departed with a handful of men, a few horses, and an unshakable belief in gold and destiny. He returned with stories of an empire made of precious metal. The Incas, whose palaces shimmered and whose gods bled treasure. And when he returned again, it was with weapons, deceit, and the plague of European arrogance. The conquest of Peru began in Panama. The isthmus had become the plank from which entire civilizations would be pushed into the abyss. The Spanish Empire now had a problem, though a logistical one. The silver and gold of the Andes were being extracted at an unimaginable scale. Potosí, the towering mining city in present-day Bolivia, was vomiting up mountains of wealth. But that treasure had to get back to Spain. and there were no oceans yet connected by a canal. So they did what empires do best. They carved a path through the jungle, no matter how many bodies it took. That path became known as the Camino Real, the Royal Road. It began at Panama City on the Pacific side and stretched across the isthmus to Nombre de Dios and later to Portobello on the Caribbean coast. Over 70 kilometers in length, the route wound through choking jungles, across rivers swollen with crocodiles, and into the hearts of mountains so steep they seemed cursed by the gods. But for the Spanish, it was the artery through which the empire breathed. Without it, Peru's riches could not reach Madrid. Without it, the empire stalled. At first, it was a rough, muddy trail, only wide enough for pack mules, enslaved porters, and Spanish soldiers. But over time, it hardened. The Spanish laid stones in the earth, creating a roadbed slick with moss and blood. Along the way, they built outposts and rest stations where goods could be transferred and guarded, and where those who couldn't walk anymore, usually natives or enslaved Africans, were left behind to die. And what moved along this trail? Silver. Tons of it. Cast into heavy bars, wrapped in llama hides, strapped to mules in caravans that stretched for miles. These caravans were protected by armed men, wary of the jungle, but more fearful of pirates. And for good reason. Gold. Ornaments melted down from Incan temples. Rings pried off dead fingers. Idols turned into ingots. The Spanish saw the gods of other cultures not as sacred beings, but as deposits to be liquefied. Slaves. Thousands of them. At first, indigenous labor was conscripted, but disease and brutality decimated their numbers. So Africans were imported, enslaved men and women ripped from kingdoms in West and Central Africa, marched through Panama like cargo. Many died in the jungle, never even reaching the mines or plantations for which they were destined. Documents, orders, secrets, carried by messengers on foot between governors and kings, between conquistadors and cardinals. Sometimes they never arrived. Sometimes what they carried was never meant to arrive. This trail became a crucible, a place where worlds collided and empires were stitched together with a thread of human suffering. The jungle along the Camino Real did not forgive. Travelers spoke of disappearing into vines that wrapped around the ankles like hungry fingers. They whispered of night sounds, animal or spirit, they couldn't say, of men who marched one day and vanished the next. The road was not a passage. It was a sentence. But it was vital. The port of Portobello, on the Caribbean end of the trail, became one of the most important trading hubs in the Spanish Empire. The Ferias de Portobello, massive trade fairs held annually, drew merchants from across the Atlantic. For weeks, the harbor swarmed with galleons, the streets crowded with gold, textiles, and human bodies. Entire fleets sailed back to Spain loaded with wealth unimaginable, all of it funneled through the spine of Panama. And so, naturally, others came to take it. By the late 1500s and early 1600s, pirates, privateers, and corsairs had turned their eyes toward Panama. Men like Francis Drake, the English sea dog turned legend, began to harass Spanish shipments, burning towns, and ambushing treasure trains. In 1572, Drake raided Nombre de Dios itself, though he was wounded in the attempt. Still, he returned, successfully ambushing a mule train of silver along the Camino Real. He buried some of the loot, hid the rest, and vanished back into the Caribbean fog. The most infamous blow came in 1671, when Henry Morgan, a Welsh privateer operating under dubious English sanction, launched an audacious attack on Panama City itself. He assembled a ragtag army of over 1,000 men, English, French, Dutch, and crossed the isthmus by land, using the old trails and indigenous guides who had no love for the Spanish. They struck the city like lightning. The Spanish tried to defend it, but were outnumbered and demoralized. Rather than let Morgan capture Panama's riches, they set fire to the city themselves. Flames devoured churches, mansions, and warehouses. The gold was lost, the city reduced to ash. Morgan's men looted what they could, but found less than they had hoped. Still, the psychological impact was enormous. The jewel of the Pacific had been plundered. the myth of Spanish invincibility cracked. And once again, Panama stood at the crossroads of imperial fantasy and violent reality. After Morgan's assault, Panama City was moved to a new location, what is now Casco Viejo, more defensible and further from the scars of the past. The jungle crept over the ruins of Panama Viejo, hiding them beneath vines and silence. But the Camino Real endured, in use for another century, until new technologies and shifting trade routes made it obsolete. Yet what lingered was something more profound, a template, a blueprint for exploitation, a demonstration that Panama was not merely a place, it was a tool, a land to be used, cut through, walked over, fought over. The Spanish had created a habit of extraction, and every power that came after would follow that example. But not everyone bowed. The enslaved resisted. Across the jungles, maroon communities, known as Cimarrones, were founded by Africans who had escaped bondage. They built hidden villages, struck at caravans, and offered shelter to those who fled the empire's chains. These Cimarrones would later form alliances with pirates, guide them through secret trails, and strike bargains to protect their autonomy. The Spanish called them rebels. The truth is, they were freedom incarnate. And the indigenous? They adapted, retreated, disguised. Some allied with the pirates. Others moved further into the hills. The jungle became not only their sanctuary, but their revenge. It devoured roads, crumbled forts, swallowed dreams. So the Camino Real, for all its ambition, became both a symbol and a warning. A path paved with imperial intent. Yes, but also with the bones of those who resisted, those who suffered, and those who endured. Today, fragments of the Camino still exist. Hidden beneath leaves, swallowed by vines, stone steps jut from the forest floor like the ribs of a long-dead giant. Walk there, and you'll hear nothing but birdsong and your own breath. But listen closely. The ground remembers. It remembers the silver-laden caravans, the muffled weeping of enslaved porters, the prayers whispered by Spanish friars and maroon war leaders alike. It remembers the weight of empire and the silence left when empire falls. Chapter 4, A Port of Shadows, Colonial Repression and Resistance. If Panama had become the spinal cord of the Spanish Empire, then its people were the marrow, extracted, exploited, and reshaped under the weight of a foreign crown. The empire needed ports and silver, bodies and silence. But beneath the silence, something stirred, something that refused to vanish. By the mid-1600s, Panama was no longer just a stopover. It was an organism, a living, breathing system designed for the efficient movement of capital, resources, and control. But it was also a scarred and shifting battleground, where repression did not eliminate resistance. It buried it underground, where it grew stronger in the dark. The city of Panama, now reestablished at Casco Viejo after Henry Morgan's infamous sack of Panama Viejo, had hardened. Its colonial walls were thick, its churches formidable, its garrisons well-stocked. Cobblestone streets bustled with a strange mix of luxury and misery. Spanish aristocrats in velvet finery, mestizo merchants hawking salt and cinnamon, barefoot children chasing feral dogs, enslaved men hauling crates of sugar and indigo under the weight of chains and Caribbean sun. The scent of roasted maize drifted through alleyways, mingling with sweat and ash. From the cathedrals, the sound of bells marked the passage of time, not the time of nature, but of empire. Every toll reminded the people that they lived under someone else's clock. The Catholic Church had become a force as powerful as the sword. Priests baptized infants before they could walk, indoctrinated children in Spanish, and stood at deathbeds to collect final confessions. They named every soul, stamped every ritual, and condemned every indigenous god as a demon. Churches rose like stone sentinels across the land, some elegant, others squat and brooding. In every cross hung above an altar, there was a shadow of a burned codex, a shattered drum, a vanished name. And yet, this was not a land conquered entirely. Afro-Panamanians, brought by force, had begun to lay their roots deep. Most had arrived as slaves in the 1500s and 1600s, men and women ripped from Yoruba, Congo, Igbo, Ashanti homelands. They arrived in shackles, often branded, their histories torn from them at sea. On arrival, they were auctioned in plazas and fed lies about inferiority. The empire viewed them as units of labor, replaceable, voiceless. But the enslaved remembered, in rhythms, in recipes, in lullabies murmured in forbidden languages, they held the thread of who they were. Plantations dotted the countryside, producing sugar, tobacco, and livestock. In the lowlands, enslaved Africans were forced to dig ditches, cut cane, clear forest, and haul timber for the ships that anchored off Portobello and Nombre de Dios. In Panama City, they built walls, paved roads, tended households, served in convents, rang church bells, and died anonymously in service of European dreams. But resistance was everywhere. It often began quietly. A broken tool. A fire that started by accident. A child given a forbidden name. A dance that defied the priests. Then, louder, a slave vanishes from a plantation. A drumbeat echoes in the jungle. A Spanish merchant is found murdered in his sleep. By the late 1600s, Cimarrones, escaped slaves, had carved out entire hidden settlements in the jungles of Darien, Cologne, and the Central Mountains. They created free communities, governed by their own rules, blending African, indigenous, and Christian traditions. These were not fragile shelters, they were bold declarations. Some had leaders who called themselves kings and queens. They cultivated land, trained warriors, and formed spiritual councils. The Spanish tried to find them, to raise them, but the jungle protected its children. Some of these maroon communities struck alliances with pirates, as both parties shared a mutual hatred of Spain. In some cases, Cimarrones would guide English raiders through the thick trails of the interior in exchange for weapons, salt, or sanctuary. In others, they would act alone, ambushing mule trains along the old Camino Real, liberating captives, disappearing again before reinforcements could arrive. The Spanish feared them, not only for their violence, but for what they represented, the inability of empire to fully contain rebellion. The African spirit had not been broken. It had merely adapted. Meanwhile, indigenous resistance evolved into endurance. The Ngay Bugle, highland dwellers with deep spiritual roots, avoided colonial assimilation by vanishing into their mountain redoubts. They lived semi-autonomously, speaking their own languages, practicing animist and Christian syncretic religions, and passing down ancestral memory through song and ceremony. While some indigenous groups had been nearly annihilated by disease or forced conversions, the Ngay adapted by retreating. They made themselves ghosts, visible only when they chose to be. The Cuna Guna, master navigators of the Caribbean, played a different game. They adopted European tools and weapons, but maintained internal governance. They moved their communities offshore, establishing a stronghold in the San Blas Archipelago, which gave them control of coastal trade and defense. They defended their culture with fierce pride and occasional violence. When Spanish missionaries attempted to force mass baptisms, the Cuna revolted, massacring friars and burning chapels. They were labeled rebellious, but they were, in truth, guardians of their sovereignty. Beneath all this resistance, there was also cultural evolution, unexpected hybrids that sprang from repression. The African and indigenous peoples intermarried. New languages emerged, Creoles, Patois, hybrid tongues blending Congo and Spanish, Ngabara and Latin. New religions blossomed from syncretism. Catholic saints fused with African orishas. Ceremonies combined baptism with ancestral invocation. One such hybrid religion, Brotherhood Catholicism, took shape in the Cofradias, lay brotherhoods formed by Afro-Panamanians and mestizos. These were technically church-approved institutions meant to allow marginalized groups to worship and participate in social rituals. But they became cultural sanctuaries. Through these groups, enslaved and free black people organized funerals, festivals, and secret gatherings. They used drums, chants, and masked dances to celebrate saints whose names they did not believe, but whose stories they transformed into allegories of survival. Out of these traditions emerged celebrations like the Congos of Portobello, a flamboyant, subversive festival of dance and theater in which enslaved people mock their masters, dress in colonial garb, and invert the social order. These performances, still alive today, were more than entertainment. They were resistance through satire. Every step mocked the empire. Every costume was a dare. At the heart of this complicated web of repression and resilience stood a society that could no longer be cleanly divided. Colonial Panama was no longer Spanish. It was not African. It was not indigenous. It was all of them, layered, broken, and reassembled. A mestizo nation in the making. But the Spanish refused to see it. They clung to their caste system. Peninsulars at the top, Spaniards born in Europe, Criollos next, Spaniards born in the Americas, then mestizos, mulattoes, zambos, and finally, the enslaved. They drew legal lines between people who shared the same blood, split families over skin tones, and demanded loyalty while denying humanity. And still, rebellion brewed. Whispers passed between markets and docks. The French are coming. The British are building ships in Jamaica. Spain is weakening. They can't hold us forever. By the late 1700s, Enlightenment ideas were seeping into Panama through contraband books and travelers. Words like liberty, rights, and revolution found their way into the hearts of Panamanians, especially the Criollos, who resented their exclusion from high office despite their wealth and Spanish ancestry. And in the shadows of church courtyards, Cimarrones still gathered to sing forbidden songs. In the hills, then Gabe whispered to their children of the old gods and the blood they once shed to protect the land. In the poor towns, Cuna still carved molas that told stories priests could not read. The empire thought it had created order, but it had only created pressure. And pressure, like fire, finds a way to crack stone.